From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we speak with one of the foremost experts on government and public policy about many issues that bear on the health of democracy in the United States. From the significance and impact of the hearings on the January 6th insurrection to women's reproductive health in the aftermath of the U.S. Supreme Court decision striking down a national right to abortion to what's at stake in the November midterm elections, we will elicit our guests' wisdom. Elaine Kmark is a senior fellow in the governance program at the Brookings Institution. That's a prominent think tank in Washington and is no stranger to these VOA microphones. Director of the Center for Effective Public Management at Brookings, Elaine specializes in electoral politics and government reform in the United States. Given that former President Trump refused to accept the fact that he lost the 2020 presidential election on and before January 6th, former President Trump tried to unlawfully pressure then Vice President Mike Pence to reject electoral votes in what should have been a largely ceremonial joint session of Congress. In that vein, we will ask her about the merits and drawbacks of reforming the Electoral Count Act. Elaine is the author of Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. So we will pick her brain about the upcoming midterm elections. What's at stake for the country, which is highly polarized? In addition, we will also discuss the ramifications of the U.S. Supreme Court's recent ruling striking down a woman's federal right to abortion. 13 states have already banned the procedure. The VOA News Center reports that Biden condemned the high court's ruling and recently signed an executive order directing the U.S. Justice Department to safeguard abortion access where it remains legal, protect women from intimidation, and protect women's rights to travel across states to seek reproductive care. For insight on this and many other critical political issues, we are delighted to welcome Elaine Kmark, who joins us via Microsoft Teams. Elaine, welcome back to the program.
It's nice to be back. Thanks for having me.
Elaine, when you were at these microphones back in December 2020, I believe, then President Donald Trump was still contesting the results, saying that he, not Biden, had won. But you said that come December 14, the gig would be up in a sense, because that was the day that each state's electors would meet and vote by paper ballot for president and vice president. End of story. Even then, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell congratulated Joe Biden as the winner. There were no more legal avenues for Mr. Trump to challenge his loss. And yet, he did just that, culminating in a violent attack on the Capitol and on democracy itself, unlike anything we have seen since the Civil War. In retrospect, Elaine Kmark, were we all a bit naive?
Well, that's a great question. And I think we were naive. This action, the plan on the part of Trump, was so unprecedented in all of American history that I think few people could believe it. And few people could believe it even as it was happening. He filed lawsuit after lawsuit. He lost 61 out of 62 lawsuits, often in courts where there were judges that had been appointed by him or other Republicans. It was really an amazing amount of chutzpah, as we say, that he had the nerve to actually try this in a country that had always been famous for its peaceful transition of power. I think we couldn't believe it, and I think a lot of people were completely surprised and probably continue to be surprised by the extent of the planning and the president's involvement in this effort.
That leads me to my next question, Elaine Kmark. We've been witnessing a set of hearings, 7 so far, by the congressional panel tasked with investigating the January 6th insurrection. These hearings have laid out their extraordinary findings about the factors and people which led to the effort to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power on January 6th. In last week's hearing, we learned how then-President Trump was at the center of efforts to derail the political process and galvanized a violence-prone and armed mob to disrupt the certification. We heard evidence from rally organizers, some which belong to violent extremist groups like the Oath Keepers, aides inside the White House, like White House counsel Pat Cipollone, all of whom said that Trump had somehow inspired and directed what transpired on January 6th. What are your thoughts in general about the hearings that we've witnessed and that particular hearing?
Let me step back for a minute, because I think the most important thing they did was establish this insurrection chronologically. And one of the first things they did in the early hearings is establish the fact that everyone around Trump who had positions of some authority, whether in the government or in the Trump campaign, had gone to Trump and told him, look, you lost. Okay, there's no way. They were telling him this on election night, that he had lost. So we have a record made by the committee that Trump was told that he had lost and continually refused to either believe it or accept it. And it was probably accept it, because I don't think he's that crazy that he didn't actually believe it. And that makes this, what unfolded afterwards, all the more dangerous. He was told that he had lost by people who should know. There was a broad consensus that he had lost. He had lost in many courts, and he still went ahead with encouraging people to try and essentially overthrow the election. And that was astonishing. Historians and psychiatrists are going to have to sort out what on earth is going on in Trump's head. Was he so out of it that he actually believed all the silly conspiracy theories? Or was he simply determined to hold on to power in spite of having lost and knowing that he lost? He certainly acts as if he truly believes he won the election in the face of overwhelming evidence against that. So we've got a real mystery here in that, what really is in Trump's head? Is he a crazy guy or is he a criminal? Neither one is a very good picture.
So Elaine Kmark, next week there will be another hearing which will lay out what Mr. Trump was doing, or rather not doing, on that fateful day when he failed to intervene to stop the mob, almost in a sense relishing their zeal. So the question is, do you think he and others will be held accountable for trying to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power, heretofore the hallmark of American democracy? Here in the United States, the legislative branch can pass laws, can make recommendations as a result of those hearings. But what do you think can and will the Justice Department do in terms of potential indictments?
That depends on essentially a political decision by the Department of Justice, and I'll tell you why. I am sure that many around him will be held accountable. I think people like Mark Meadows, chief of staff, will be held accountable. I think others around Trump will be held accountable. I think his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, will be held accountable. I think there will be many people who will be facing criminal charges and potentially jail. Whether or not the Justice Department goes after Trump, I think depends less on the legal case and more on the question of, does it do more or less harm to democracy to actually try and prosecute a former president of the United States? And, you know, I think there's a good case to be made on either side. On the one hand, if in fact they make the case that Trump really was directing this whole thing and had criminal intent, then justice should be done. On the other hand, frankly, taking apart his support system, putting some people in jail, et cetera, is going to have a chilling effect on any future Trump candidacies. We're already seeing Republican primary voters expressing a desire to have somebody else besides Donald Trump be the 2024 nominee. And so we're in the situation where he is being deflated by this, and perhaps that's enough. The most important thing to accomplish here is that Trump is never, ever, as Liz Cheney has said, within 1,000 feet of the presidency ever again. He is a dangerous man. Again, whether it's criminal intent or whether he just lives in a fantasy world, they're both very dangerous things for a president of the United States to be accused of. And so he can't ever be president again. If there's some way to keep that from happening, because either legally or simply politically, that is the objective here. And so I think we'll have to see, and people will have to make that decision. And I think it's a hard one. I think it's a tough one. And as I said, you can see the pros and cons for either course of action.
Elaine, if Donald Trump is not the 2024 presidential candidate, the Republican Party base is still in the thrall of Donald Trump. They seem to embrace some of his authoritarian tendencies, like the notion that one does not have to accept the results of a Democratic election. And when one loses, one can embrace political violence as legitimate, which then leads me to ask you about the need to reform the Electoral Count Act, which would explicitly confirm that the vice president does not have the power to alter the electoral vote count, something that Trump tried to do but failed because then Vice President Pence resisted the pressure. And so second, there is also a danger from state legislatures, particularly Republican-dominated legislatures, which are interested in superseding the role of neutral election monitors in confirming the results of elections.
I think the action in Republican state legislatures is very concerning because essentially what they would like to do is go back to a time when there really wasn't a clear statewide vote, unlike today when there's a very clear statewide vote and many mechanisms for counting and recounting that vote. I mean, Trump was allowed recounts in places where normally you wouldn't even have a recount because the margins were big enough to say you don't need it. So Trump had his day in court. And there are many, many legal protections in place already for getting an accurate count out of a state. They're attempting to bring that judgment back to the state legislature, which is extremely dangerous, extremely dangerous. On the other hand, in the elections that we've seen so far, and we've been watching lots of primary elections, Trump-backed candidates have not always won. They've actually, and let me just clarify something for our audience. You will hear Trump brag about his endorsement rate, how many of his endorsed candidates have won. By far and away, most of the candidates that Donald Trump is endorsing in Republican primaries are either incumbents who win 98% of the time with or without Donald Trump, and or they are people in uncontested races. In other words, there's somebody with no opponent in the race. So his braggadocio is basically false. When it comes to actual contested races, Trump has won some and he's lost some. In the ones that he has lost, the Trump backed candidates have not pursued the Trump-like agenda of declaring the election to be invalid, which I think is interesting and gives me some hope that this authoritarian impulse is something that only Donald Trump could actually pull off and believe. Because the other Trump losers so far in the primaries are accepting the results of the election.
Elaine, before we go to the break, what about reforming the Electoral Count Act? While it won't solve the bigger problem, many analysts say, it would at least place a check on anyone like a Donald Trump who tried to say that the vice president could alter the electoral vote count. Of course, that's what he wanted Mike Pence to do, but he refused to do that, which saved the day, except for the fact that we had a violent insurrection anyway. So what are the prospects of reforming the Electoral Count Act? Do we have the votes? Can it be done in this session of Congress before the midterms?
Well, it needs to be done. It needs to be clarified that the vice president can't make up vote counts and you have to accept the vote counts as reported from the states. There is bipartisan agreement on this. I hope that they get it done before the midterms because who knows what's going to happen in the midterms. I mean, the Republicans could take both houses of Congress. On the other hand, there is a fair amount of Republican support for this because nobody really wants to. After all, what could happen to what Trump tried to do, some Democrat could try to do down the road. It just makes no sense in a system where we are accustomed to free and fair elections, where states have elaborate election apparatus and many legal checks and balances inside that apparatus. It's crazy that the vice president of the United States, who has a vested interest in the outcome, could in fact overrule the results of the vote in a state. So I'm hopeful that they get it done soon. Even if they don't get it done soon, there's still a possibility that it would pass.
You are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. Our guest is Elaine Kmark, Senior Fellow in the Governance Studies Program and Director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution, a think tank based in Washington. We are discussing several issues dominating the U.S. political landscape. And this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available on most of your favorite podcast apps. You may also download the show by plugging in the following address to your web browser, voaafrica.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Ayatollah Daniel Tong from Juba, South Sudan. Thanks so much for your feedback on Facebook, Daniel Tong. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter. So back to our special guest, Elaine Kmark. Elaine, now I'd like to turn to abortion rights. As we all know, the Supreme Court struck down Roe versus Wade, the almost 50-year ruling that said abortion is a constitutional right. This kicks the issue of abortion access to each of the 50 states, more than a dozen of which have imposed almost total bans on the procedure. This is viewed as a nationwide setback for women and families. As a result, as you know, the Biden administration is doing what it can, although there are limits on what the executive branch can do to mitigate the implications for reproductive rights. Do you think the Biden administration is doing enough? He issued an executive order. What more can he do to assure that women are not penalized because of the state in which they live?
Well, I think Biden is limited. After all, I mean, we are in a system of separated powers. So the Supreme Court is an equal branch of government and it has made its decision. So Biden himself is limited. Biden plus the Congress could change that, but there's not enough votes in the Congress. So the options are limited. Now, I think the most important thing, which he did in that executive order, which they will continue to do, is to make sure that medicated abortions are still available and that people can order them through the mail and be able to use a medicated form of abortion. It surprised me, being of a certain age, when I started learning about abortion politics again, that already before the Supreme Court decision, most abortions in the United States were medicated abortions. And that means taking one pill followed by several weeks later and then taking a second pill and then basically having a miscarriage. And that means that the existence of abortion providers in medical settings where somebody has to go to a place and you have to have a doctor or a trained physician do the abortion, it means that that is somewhat less important than it used to be. My guess is there will be a great deal of attention paid to medicated abortions and that that will become absolutely the dominant form of abortion. And I think that the president does have it in his power because of his control over the Department of Health and Human Services and his control over the Food and Drug Administration to make sure that medicated abortions are easy to get. And therefore, it won't mean traveling to another state. I think the second thing to know about what we're facing is that there will be a patchwork of laws and regulations from state to state. And already we've paid a lot of attention to the states that are banning abortion altogether. We've paid less attention to the states that are protecting abortion and expanding the number of abortion providers in their states in anticipation of an influx of patients. So, for instance, in Maryland, they passed a law a few weeks ago that would allow nurse practitioners and physician's assistants and a few other medical professionals to be trained to perform abortions. And they put money behind that for that training. What this means is that Maryland is anticipating that people will be driving up from states in the South, flying into Baltimore in order to get abortion care. And by the way, Maryland's not the only state. Connecticut has done this. Oregon has done this. California has done this. So we'll have two kinds of states, right? We'll have states where it's almost impossible to get an abortion. And then we'll have states that are abortion providers. Now, that doesn't mean that it won't be difficult, because if you can't get a medicated abortion, people are still going to have to take time off work. They're going to have to travel, et cetera. And of course, this hurts the poor and women of color more than it does middle class or upper middle class women. So it's an interesting picture we're looking at. You have to go back to the days of segregation, or even to the days of slavery, to see a nation so divided between states on a policy that affects a large number of its citizens. And that's what we're looking at here with abortion and abortion care. And, you know, the president has tools in his toolkit. They've announced some in that executive order. They've got a task force up and running that I think will look for different ways to use federal authority to at least enable the providing of abortions in some states, if not in others.
As you alluded before, President Biden did say that the fastest way to effectively restore Roe versus Wade is to codify it into law. But he said to do that, he needs a Congress controlled by Democrats, and urged people, especially women, to go out and vote. So that leads me to my next question. Will the abortion issue help drive Democrats to the polls in November?
I think it will. I think we're already seeing it. There's something in American politics called the generic vote, where they ask the public, do you want to vote for a Democrat or a Republican in the November elections? And before this decision, that generic vote was heavily in favor of the Republicans by 6 or 7 points. Now, more recently, that generic vote is tied. And frankly, if the Democrats pick up about 3 or 4 points in that generic vote, that means that they have an outside chance of keeping the House of Representatives. So we're already seeing the impact of abortion on the midterms. Secondly, I think we're going to really see them in some state elections, particularly for Senate. Again, even before the Supreme Court decision, people thought that it was going to be easier to hold the Senate than hold the House. And now I think it's become much easier to hold the Senate. That's been helped by Trump's interventions in Senate Republican nominees, and he's got some very, very bad candidates out there. Herschel Walker, who's running for Senate in Georgia against a former minister. You know, Herschel Walker is just one lie after another. I mean, nothing he says absolutely is true. And long time ago, he was a star football player that everybody adored. The fact of the matter is that he's long past his prime there, and there's absolutely no reason to think he's fit to be a senator of the United States. So I think that the Senate is a brighter spot for Democrats than the House, but I think they are both in better shape than they were before the Supreme Court decision.
Well, that seems like a silver lining, Elaine Kmark, some good coming from what otherwise would be a dark cloud, at least for Democrats, because as you know, Elaine, historically, the party in power that holds the executive and legislative branches like the Democrats do, albeit rather tenuously, with very slim margins of 50-50 Senate and the thinnest of margins in the House of Representatives, they usually lose seats in one or both chambers in midterm elections. So it will be very interesting to see come November what happens if the Democrats can defy the historical trend. I have one more follow-up. We've seen family fights within the party, the Democratic Party. The progressive wing especially is highly critical of President Biden, accusing him of not doing enough, fast enough, whether on the economy or on reproductive rights. Are you confident that they will come out and vote for Democrats no matter what in the midterms?
Oh, yes. I mean, in fact, even the polls show that. They show that people are highly critical of Biden. And then when asked in a Biden-Trump matchup, who would they vote for? They say Biden by overwhelming numbers. You know, there's a lot of unhappiness with Biden. Some of it is just nothing Biden can do anything about. People think he's too old. You know, and there's not much you can do about that. You can't change your age in the middle of a campaign, right? So some of that is just what it is. But I think that looking at the general election, if Trump is on the ballot, I think the Democrats will all come to whoever the nominee is and in a very, very cohesive way. And I think the only way Democrats would not, and it would be if there's some sort of miracle happens and the Republican Party actually nominates a centrist candidate. That would be a big surprise. Okay. And that could get independent and Democratic voters crossing over. But right now, that looks like pretty unlikely to happen.
So you were talking mostly about the 2024 presidential elections, but I'd like to get you on the record. In the midterms, when the president is not on the ballot, just congressional and state races are at stake. Are you confident that the more center-left, left Democrats will come out and vote?
Yeah, I think abortion is going to be a very much a motivating factor for Democrats, even for Democrats who are unhappy with Biden. I mean, look, they're not unhappy with Biden's position, right? They just think Biden was too slow. So in that sort of situation, you say, yeah, well, I wish the guy would have done this faster instead of in 2 weeks. I wish he would have done it in 2 days. But in the end, you're voting for somebody on their policy and they don't disagree with Biden on the policy.
And Elaine, what about inflation if it continues to bedevil the government?
Yeah, inflation is a terrible problem for any president. I've written often that inflation for a president is the problem from hell. There are so few things a president can do about inflation, and yet he or she bears the brunt of people suffering. They blame them. So it really is a difficult problem. There, I think Biden is, again, I don't think he has many options. I think he has taken the options that he could take. It does look like the price of gas has dropped every day for the last 28 days in a row. So it looks like maybe some of his actions, like on opening up the strategic oil reserve, are helping lower gasoline prices. But inflation, Biden could lose a lot of independents to Republicans. And that, I think, is more powerful than other things. The question is really going to be, does abortion motivate more than inflation? And that, I think, is what it's going to come down to. And that's a tough one. I don't think we know the answer to that yet.
Elaine Kmark, with respect to 2024, Democrats are discussing options other than Joe Biden in 2024, citing his age and other things. They complain he will be too old by then. What are the options, in your view, other than Kamala Harris? Who else could step in and be a successful candidate against a Republican, whether Donald Trump or someone else?
Well, there's a lot of unhappiness with Biden because of his age. On the other hand, I would remind people that Nancy Pelosi, 4 years ago, there was a lot of unhappiness because of her age. And then people realized, wait a minute, she was really a pretty good Speaker of the House. And they reelected her. Okay, even though she's older than Biden, she's 82 years old. So you have to balance age versus what are they doing. And I think that what Biden is really going to be rewarded for is the way he has dealt with the Ukraine situation. He has not gotten us into a head-on war and potentially a nuclear war with Russia, which, you know, you can imagine some other previous presidents of the United States blundering us into. He has really done, I think, a terrific job. His judgment has been very sound on that. So he may get rewarded for his judgment, which would be very nice. And the age, as I say, what can you do about it? It is what it is. The other option before him is to wait through the midterms and then announce that he's not running again. If he's not running again, then I think Democrats would have a wide open primary. I think certainly Vice President Kamala Harris would be a powerful contender, but I suspect that other people would get into that mix as well.
Elaine, thank you for bringing up the foreign policy angle. Foreign policy always figures much more in the presidential as opposed to congressional elections. And according to analysts, President Biden has excelled on that front, particularly by galvanizing our transatlantic partners and NATO in the face of Russia's aggression in Ukraine. Elaine Kmark is senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program and director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution. Elaine, thank you so much for your time and your keen insights on so many critical issues.
Carol, thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.